Following are comments on William Shakespeare's King Lear, Act I. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less. Cordelia enrages her father the king by refusing to flatter him. Almost everyone who studies King Lear notices the fairy tale or folk tale quality of Act I, Scene 1. Once upon a time, an old king had three daughters, and so forth. Let's begin by comparing this opening with a folktale type called Love Like Salt, as articulated by author Charlotte Arteze, spelled A-R-T-E-S-E, in her 2019 book Shakespeare and the Folktale. This tale resembles Cinderella, but Love Like Salt varieties posit that the father or king demands to know which daughter has the most affection for him. That's what King Lear does when he asks Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia, quote unquote, which of you shall we say doth love us most? Act 1, Scene 1, line 49. Goneril and Regan flatter on command, but a cat must have Cordelia's tongue, since like the protagonists of Love Like Salt stories, she is unable to respond to her father's liking. Cordelia gives Lear an answer grounded in a sense of feudal obligation. She tells the king, quote unquote, I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 90 through 91. He quickly becomes enraged and disinherits her, which is, of course, the error that starts the play's downward motion towards tragedy. By the way, what Cordelia says sounds like what Cordela, spelled C-O-R-D-E-I-L-L-A, says in a couple of Shakespeare's historical sources, Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain and Raphael Holinshed's Chronicles of England, Scotland, and Ireland. In Monmouth, Cordela says in part, quote unquote, look how much you have, so much is your value, and so much I love you. In Holinshed, she says, quote unquote, ascertain yourself that so much as you have, so much you are worth, and so much I love you and no more. Which is to say, I love you exactly as much as you deserve, no more, no less. So in any of these versions, Cordelia's answer is exasperating to King Lear. It's as exasperating as the folktale heroine's expression, quote unquote, I love you like fresh meat loves salt, is to the misguided patriarch in Love Like Salt tales. But our patriarchs in these stories don't consider why such an answer is actually a good one. Today, we have refrigeration, but before the 20th century, and by the way, the setting of King Lear dates to the 8th century BCE, people needed to salt their meat so it would be available during winter. Salt is a preservative, unlovable by itself, but essential to life. It has sustaining power. King Lear prefers the sugar talk that Goneril and Regan, those baristas from hell, serve him with such skill. He doesn't realize that their pretty words will only further corrupt his heart. While Lear isn't outright asking his daughters to lie, he's opening the door wide for their courtly flattery, and they're entirely willing to oblige, even though they see the problem with the contest. The king will one day find that Cordelia's love is indeed more like salt than sugar. Like Kent, Gloucester, and Edgar, she will be there for him when he needs her, but that level of insight will take a good deal of suffering for Lear to achieve. So we see Goneril and Regan in action, flattering their father. And we see Cordelia offer only a tight-lipped non-response that gets her banished. It's worth asking, why couldn't Cordelia flatter her frail old father? What kind of politician is she, anyway? We know the quip, if a politician's lips are moving, he or she is lying. It's a minimum requirement for the job, isn't it? Being a ruler calls for mastery of many different discursive styles, and it isn't a stretch to say one must know how to sweet-talk people. Dissimulation is among the arts of governance. In his book, Shakespeare and the Bible, author Stephen Marks reminds us that King James I's private Latin motto was, quote unquote, qui nescit dissimulare, nescit regnare. Whoever doesn't know how to dissimulate doesn't know how to rule. Why? Anyone who feels bound always to tell the truth is also burdened with the need to verify that the truth is true. The liar is not similarly burdened. He or she is much more free just to make up something. To paraphrase Oscar Wilde, anyone who tells a lie and feels obligated to give valid evidence for it might as well tell the truth at once. Basically, Lear is commanding his daughters to flatter him in a way that involves genuine affection. Perhaps that's a tall order. It seems self-contradictory. But don't most children pull it off pretty well when they want something their parents may be reluctant to give them? You can love someone and yet flatter them in a spirit of generous excess. But more on that later. Clearly, Cordelia can't or won't do it, and the cost of this refusal will prove catastrophic to her. But that's enough Cordelia bashing. I don't mean to take an ungenerous, anti-Cordelia approach to the contest scene. In the end, we will see that Cordelia truly loves her father and does her best to save him, even if her efforts are doomed. Her love will prove as vital as salt to the suffering old king. We must do something, and in the heat. Goneril and Regan deliver to Lear the flattery that he wants, and immediately afterward begin scheming how to consolidate their power. Still in Act 1, Scene 1, both Regan and Goneril are fundamentally lying politicians, and quite willing to play up to their frail old father. They seem resentful of Lear's genuine affection for Cordelia, and they're not shocked by his behavior because they know his character defects thoroughly. Regan says pointedly, quote unquote, he hath ever but slenderly known himself. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 288 through 289. Their rhetoric trades on hyperbole and a device known as adunaton, spelled A-D-Y-N-A-T-O-N, meaning, quote-unquote, inability to say or do something. And it works well, given Lear's shallowness. The moment Lear hands over the realm to Regan and Goneril, they start scheming to keep him safely out of the way so they can govern. That's understandable, but what isn't understandable is the cruel excess and evident satisfaction with which they go about their project. Early on, the urgency in their tone is palpable. As Goneril says to Regan, quote unquote, we must do something, and in the heat. Act 1, Scene 1, line 302. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom. King Lear divides his realm and casts away his responsibilities. Still with respect to Act 1, Scene 1, some critics insist that it was a terrible mistake for King Lear to divide his kingdom into portions. It's most convenient to set aside the divided rule theory with a maybe. If Shakespeare means to follow Norton and Sackville's Gorboduc, an early tragedy, then he saw Lear's dividing his kingdom as a problem. Otherwise, probably not. Underlying this theory is the claim that the king was wrong to give up power at all. The fool keeps repeating this thesis. Well, if you look at what Lear says and how he behaves, there's some plausibility to this theory. Since he wants to keep the title and many of the perks of office, but none of the responsibilities. That's a bad idea, and his daughters quickly let him know about it. They're not wrong. He's getting in their way, which is irresponsible and can't be allowed to continue. But the most interesting error seems to be how Lear divides the kingdom and to whom he gives it. It's easy to see that the old king is shallow, used to getting his way, and ignorant of the need to keep different kinds of love separate. He seems to want a public contest in which his politician-ruler daughters will compete over who sincerely loves him most and can best express it in flowery speeches. I expressed an opinion on this above, and I hold to it, but all the same, there's domestic or familial affection, and there's public loyalty and obligation. They're not the same thing, even if they can coexist. We should be able to discern from Gonorilla and Regan's performance and from what they say to each other immediately after the performance that, simply put, they are not good people, and they don't mean the king well. Perhaps King Lear's problem is that, based on shallow evidence, he picks the wrong daughter. His prior instincts to favor Cordelia in the division were correct, and he's wrong to disinherit and banish her to the advantage of Goneril and Regan. What wouldst thou do, old man? Kent's caustic heroism and the King of France's moral clarity shine forth. Still in Act 1, Scene 1, Kent, like Cordelia, will be with Lear when it's most vital, even though he can't prevent a tragic outcome. The man is heroic in his loyal attempt to speak truth to damn full power, and this quality is on display from Act 1, Scene 1 onward. As he puts his case, quote unquote, "To plainness honors bound when majesty falls to folly." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 146 through 147. The same is true of the King of France. He's like a romance hero, taking up a good woman who's been unfairly cast aside. He may remind us of Prince Charming in Cinderella. The best thing about him is his moral clarity. Undiluted and unintimidated by power, he sees what the king's warped love contest really signifies. As he says, quote unquote, "Not all the dukes of Watrish Burgundy can buy this unprized precious maid of me." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 256 through 257. Now, gods, stand up for bastards. Gloucester's illegitimate son, Edmund, endures his father's crude introduction of him to Kent, declares his intent to prosper, and dupes his brother Edgar out of his title with a malevolent and false letter expressing hostility towards Gloucester. Shakespeare's complex way of building up a character works well for his development of Edmund. Already in Act 1, Scene 1, we can see for ourselves why Edmund despises his legitimate brother Edgar and his father Gloucester. Near the opening of the play, Gloucester mocks Edmund's mother and his illegitimacy in front of Kent, and not even the old man's expression of sincere affection for the lad can make up for that kind of abuse. The Earl's declaration, quote unquote, "The whoreson must be acknowledged," is not a foundation for a mutually respectful relationship between father and son. Act 1, Scene 1, line 22. In Edgar and the Earl of Gloucester, Edmund sees a pair of credulous fools who hold sway only because of their birth, their name. In Act 1, Scene 2, it becomes clear that Edmund is full of ambition. He is obsessed with getting back at the legitimate, so-called, stumbling blocks to his advancement. He is contemptuous of their belief in the sway of the stars, though this was an all but universal belief in Shakespeare's England, and declares his allegiance to a very particular construction of nature. Quote unquote, "Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law my services are bound." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 1 through 2. Edmund might as well add to his term, nature, Alfred Tennyson's qualifying phrase, quote unquote, "red in tooth and claw," as that poet describes mere nature in Canto 66 of In Memoriam Arthur Henry Hallam. Edmund spends Act 1, Scene 2, savagely duping his brother Edgar and his father Gloucester, the vehicle of the deception being that he claims to have received a damning letter from Edgar expressing a wish to kill the old man. It's a shallow plot, to say the least, but Gloucester nonetheless believes it at once, and without question. Edmund caps off his personal credo with the memorable utterance, quote unquote, "I grow, I prosper. Now, gods, stand up for bastards." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 21 through 22. Soon, he will join up with Regan, her husband Cornwall, and Goneril, villains all who are coming to the fore thanks to Lear's mistakes. Edmund's belief in his own charm and strength is clear, quote unquote, "All with me's meat, that I can fashion fit." Act 1, Scene 2, line 162. It's an old belief, and in advancing it, Edmund is in company with many a brute in fiction and real life. In The History of the Peloponnesian War, Thucydides has the imperialist Athenian envoys threatening the people of Melos with the taunt, quote unquote, "The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must." Sweet heaven, keep me in temper, I would not be mad. Lear's regrets and spiritual darkness descend upon him. In Act 1, Scenes 4 and 5, King Lear begins to sense his mistake in casting off Cordelia. But it's too late to undo what has been done. Goneril begins to put her foot down, so Lear curses her and begins to fear that he'll go mad. The fool and Kent prove their worth in their own ways. Does the fool's advice seem wise? Well, perhaps he's a good diagnostician, and he keeps us from over-pitying King Lear. But he can't fix anything that his master has done. He can say, quote unquote, "I had rather be any kind of thing than a fool, and yet I would not be thee, nuncle. Thou hast pared thy wit of both sides and left nothing in the middle." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 155 through 157. Kent's love is demonstrated in action, as when in Act 1, Scene 4, he gets himself taken into Lear's service as Caius and trips the arrogant, foppish steward Oswald for disrespecting the king at Goneril's bidding. Things will soon get much darker, but we should note how far downhill they have already gone, even by the end of the first act. This play may seem messy and sprawling, but Lear's descent into madness and suffering proceeds with terrible swiftness. At the end of Act 1, Scene 5, King Lear is already desperate, praying to the gods, quote unquote, "Oh, let me not be mad, not mad. Sweet heaven, keep me in temper. I would not be mad." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 39 through 40. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Saturday, July 6th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from King Lear, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.